You may proceed.
May it please the court. Matthew Fender for Joseph Levin. This case presents but a single issue, and that issue is whether the circuit court had jurisdiction at the time that it entered an order revoking Mr. Levin's commission as special conservator of the peace. And because that order was entered more than 21 days after the entry of a final order, the court lacked jurisdiction. Now, the issue that we're here on today is one of extraordinary public importance. Finality of judgments in Virginia is a bedrock principle of law, one that's essential to the functioning of our court system. And the decision below created a new exception to the 21-day rule, one that is without precedent in common law and one which is not fairly applied in the statute.
Without precedent in common law?
Your Honor, there are a handful of well-known exceptions to the 21-day rule.
But the common law of appointing authority in a non-adversarial proceeding is actually quite rich and very ancient. The power to remove is implied in the power to appoint. In fact, in common law, that principle applied to special conservators of the peace by name.
Well, Your Honor, that may very well be true. However, and with respect to law construing the 21-day rule, being a principle which is in derogation of common law that came prior to the adoption of that rule, there's no case law that we're aware of that it creates an exception allowing the court to have continuing jurisdiction to revoke an appointment.
Well, common law can't be repealed by rule of court. It can be repealed by the Constitution and repealed by statute. But rule 1:1 is not a statute. It's a rule of court. We could have easily said 22 days or 52 days. How can a court expand or contract its own jurisdiction by its own fiat?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that there's a rich body of law construing the 21-day rule and holding that it, you know, it means what it says. I'd also point out that with respect to the concealed handgun permit statute, which is analogous and which was extensively argued below, the legislature saw fit to explicitly provide that the circuit court has continuing jurisdiction to revoke those permits under certain circumstances.
Your petition, though, or the employer's petition, asked the court to make the appointment for 4 years, quote, unless revoked by order of this court, end quote, which is the petition. Then the appointment order says the conservator's appointment shall remain subject to the following provisions of this order, and the continuing condition subsequent to maintaining the appointment is the conservator must comply with all applicable statutes, laws applicable to special conservators of the peace. And obviously being registered by the board is the most important applicable condition subsequent. So how did the court not have authority to enforce its own order? Sort of like an injunction, really.
Well, the court found that it had implied authority in the statute, and that was the authority that the court relied upon. Our reading of the statute shows no such implied authority. There is, and you know, we don't know the legislative history, we don't know the motives of the General Assembly, but there is, in fact, a well-known procedure by which the Commonwealth could have come forward and sought to revoke Mr. Levin's commission.
Well, his registration's been revoked, right, by the board.
The registration has, in fact, been revoked, but by contention, that has no bearing on his present commission.
Well, by law, is he allowed to serve without being presently on the register?
Well, the statute says only that no person can be appointed without being presently on the register. Nothing in the statute.
How much sense does it make to say you've got to be on the register to be appointed, but the day afterwards you can fall off the register for any number of reasons, including crimes? And you have a right to keep your appointment. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, Your Honor, that may very well be true as a matter of the policy, and there is a procedural avenue by which the Commonwealth can proceed to have that commission revoked. Here, Mr. Lovin was deprived of that procedure and was deprived of the procedural protections that would have gone along with it.
Do you mean the APA? Do you mean the Administrative Process Act?
No, Your Honor. The Commonwealth had only to file an independent action. Essentially, their contention here is that the Circuit Court erred, right? That the Department, you know, issued a registration that it shouldn't have issued, and therefore the Circuit Court's judgment granting the commission was made in error. And if that's the case, this court's law makes it clear that the Commonwealth could have brought an independent action. And had the Commonwealth done so, Mr. Lovin would have been able to avail himself of a myriad of procedural protections. He could have brought a plea and bar. He could have filed a demurrer. He would have had access to discovery.
Did Mr. Lovin file an APA appeal, an administrative appeal of the board's revocation of its registry entry?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe he did.
And has that come to closure?
I believe it has.
Say again?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it has.
And what was the result?
I was not counsel in that, Your Honor, but I believe that Mr. Levin's lost that.
So right now, Mr. Lovin, by statute, is not permitted to exercise any powers of the special conservator of the peace. Is that true?
Well, let me answer that in two problems. First of all, he certainly could not presently be appointed as a special conservator because he lacks a registration. Because he lacks an appointment, he cannot exercise powers of the special conservator of the peace.
So you're saying the law precludes him from getting it, but once he has it, the law doesn't have any problem with him continuing to exercise these otherwise unlawful powers?
Unless revoked. And it's just our contention that the procedure necessary to revoke the commission was not followed here. Rather, the court acted without jurisdiction.
Well, actually, under the statute, the board has the ability to revoke.
The board has
the ability to revoke the registration. And then it's clear in the statute, 9.1-150.2, that he wouldn't be able to exercise any of these abilities.
Well, Your Honor, our reading of the statute is that he would not be able to be appointed without a registration, but that once appointed, he'd be able to exercise the powers once his commission has been revoked.
But let's suppose he murdered somebody after the appointment and was convicted of it during the 4 years, and he lost his registry entry, the board revoked his registry entry. You're saying that the court who issued the appointment order doesn't have the inherent implied authority during the term to revoke his appointment?
Your Honor, in our contention, there's no statutory basis.
So the answer would be, yes, the court has no power, and the murderer continues to have the court's appointment to be a conservator. How could the legislature possibly have intended that?
Your Honor, the legislature, it's clear from comparing the concealed handgun permit to the statute, this legislature knows how to write into a statute this continuing jurisdiction if it so chooses, and it chose not to do so here. There is a procedure by which that commission could be revoked. And it's our contention that's the procedure that should properly have been employed.
Counsel, while we're talking about the court's authority, would you look at page 1 through 4 of the joint appendix? Excuse me, that would be 1 through 5 of the joint appendix.
Page 1 through 4?
1 through 5. That's the petition that was filed on behalf of Mr. Levin by his employer for him to become a special conservator piece.
Right.
You'll note that Eagle Protective Group represents itself to be a corporation. You'll also note that the individual who filed it represents himself to be the chief executive officer, and his signature as the chief executive officer for Eagle Protective Group, Inc. appears on page 10, which is the order that appointed Mr. Levin. Is that chief, and he does not have a Virginia bar number listed. Is there anything in the record indicating that the chief executive officer of Eagle Protective Group, Inc. is a Virginia attorney?
There is no information in the record to that effect, Your Honor, and I confess I don't know. It would be our contention that any argument that the petition wasn't valid because it was signed on behalf of a corporation by someone not a lawyer would have been waived and merged into the court's final order.
Well, many things can be waived and merged. This court, three times in the past decade, has said that a pleading filed by someone who is not a duly licensed attorney and is acting in a representative capacity for a corporation is invalid and without legal effect. If the petition was invalid and without legal effect, would that not make the order itself void? And can voidness not be raised at any time by either the litigants or the court itself?
Certainly, Your Honor, voidness can be raised at any time. Our examination of the cases on a pleading signed by someone, not an attorney, on behalf of another, and I'm sure the court was correct, but I'm not aware of one where it actually merged into a final order. The cases that I'm familiar with involve a responsive pleading or something filed during the conduct of a case, the parties in default or something like that. Here, where it's actually been merged into the final order, we would argue that the distinction, you know, operates, that, you know, it doesn't allow you to collaterally attack an order once the order itself has been.
And that would be by implication from our cases rather than a specific case.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know if it's just a case where the court has addressed that particular question.
Okay. Are you aware of Senate Bill 1195 that's currently under consideration in the General Assembly?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Well, let me tell you what it says. It actually, 2 days ago, it went into conference over relatively minor things of disagreement between the House and the Senate. But among other things, it says, the Circuit Court shall retain jurisdiction for 4 years over any order it enters pursuant to this section and may revoke such appointment at any time for good cause shown. It would appear that if this passes, and it appears that it will, that this clearly would trump Rule 1:1, and it would appear to me not to be a substantive matter. It's a, at least my initial reaction is it is procedural in nature. But where does that put you?
Well, Your Honor, again, I'm not familiar with the statute, but we would suggest the fact that the legislature feels inclined to pass a statute points to the fact that our position is essentially correct and that the law as it stands today, as it stood on the day that Mr. Levin was before the Circuit Court and his commission was revoked, that the court, in fact, lacked jurisdiction. Otherwise, the General Assembly wouldn't, you know, feel the need to pass a statute.
Well, often they do things that are declarative of existing law. I don't know how they will characterize this. But it seems to me that should you win on the following day, you will lose.
And, Your Honor, that, were that to be the case, we suppose that would be an issue for another day. But I'm going to try to reserve the rest of my time to point out that, you know, the 21-day rule is important. It's important to the operation of courts here in Virginia. And we think we ask the court to vindicate the policy behind the 21-day rule in Rule 11 today.
All right. You have 2 minutes, 43 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honors. Charles Pagliato on behalf of the Department of Criminal Justice Services. The Department's position is pretty clear that the court does have inherent authority to revoke these SCAP appointments. When the trial court entered its March 24, 2014 order revoking the appointment of Joseph Levin, it looked at the Special Conservative Fee Statute and found that in subsection B, it contained language concerning shall be registered. And looked at that language and found that it had jurisdiction to revoke Mr. Levin's SCAP appointment when it was presented with evidence of his noncompliance with the statute. Hearing Your Honor's questions to opposing counsel, this court is concerned and shares the concerns of the department that opposing counsel's point of view would allow courts just to sit idly by while SCAPs may commit crimes and have no authority to revoke their orders until it's brought by an independent action, which, you know, does seem problematic. The courts do have an inherent authority.
Why is that problematic?
Well, it's problematic because there's going to be a time gap. If an independent action needs to be filed, you're going to have some time where the court will just have someone serving as an SCOP for a period of days, maybe months, where it could be a especially heinous crime, and he has the powers to arrest without a warrant, maybe to carry a weapon. I mean, those are potentially pretty severe and damaging acts to the public. And that's why it seems unnecessary that the court should have to wait that long. Furthermore, this independent action that opposing counsel advances is also problematic.
What exactly is this independent action? I mean, it's not an action in equity, and if his first premise is right, which is there's no power to upset the appointment order, you can't create the power just by filing an independent action.
And I believe that's the problem. There really is no independent action. What opposing counsel relies on is 8.1-428D, which lays out a five-prong test to basically provides an equity action to overturn a judgment that shouldn't have been entered. The problem is these SCOP orders are done ex parte. There's no one on the other side. So there's really no defending to say the judgment was entered incorrectly. And I'd note that these SCOP orders can be...
Why wouldn't 8.01428D be the appropriate independent action?
Well, there is no opposing party. So it would essentially be a party, some strange party, trying to seek the revoking of the SCOP appointment.
Or somebody must have sought it because the court wouldn't have granted it sua sponte.
Well, in this particular case, the department filed a motion to revoke an order within the original petition.
I think what Judge Powell was saying, why wouldn't the proper procedure be for them to file a motion under 8.01-428?
Well, and that's what 8.1-428 contemplates, that the judgment shouldn't be enforced against the defense. And there's no defense here. There's no other party here.
I don't think that's what it says. I think it says it's to set aside the judgment.
It is, but the five-prong test that's laid out talks about there must be a good defense to the action, that the must not be any fault or negligence on behalf of the defense. That's the fourth prong. It does lay out that it's the opposing party seeking the review of the judgment, not some third party who wasn't part of the initial action. And I'd note this would be particularly problematic because for these SCOP orders, you may have sheriffs or chiefs of police who file these applications. Certainly, they shouldn't have to go and have some third party file an independent action seeking to revoke the petition they themselves have filed. Certainly, sheriffs and chiefs of police would be very interested in having these orders revoked.
It seems like to me somebody's got to ask.
Right, somebody.
We're talking about how they ask, not whether anybody has to ask. Because certainly you're not saying it ought to be sua sponte done by a court. They read something in the paper and they just revoke a guy. I mean, somebody's going to have to come to the court and ask the court to do something.
But I think the court can do it sua sponte. I don't think there's anything that...
But do you really think that's going to happen? I mean, we're going to have circuit court judges scouring papers to see if there's something that somebody did that they ought to be revoked? But somebody's going to have to bring it to the attention of the court.
But in the same token, if the circuit court is explicitly aware of a defendant they're sentencing and has an SCOP order because that court signed the order... The court shouldn't sit idly by and have to wait for
that. I agree with that. I'm just saying in this particular instance, that's not what happened. Somebody brought this to the attention of the court.
Correct. The department filed a motion to revoke
exactly.
The order.
So why are you so resistant to them filing something when they indeed did file something? You seem to think it's very onerous. It was onerous for them to have done so, but I don't understand how else they would have ever gotten in front of the court.
And I guess what I'm resistant to, or what the department is resistant to, is the idea that it has to be shoehorned within this 8.1428D subsection, which is what opposing counsel
D
answers.
Is the independent equity action of that statute. A is the bill of review codification, which is a motion in the same proceeding in the same court.
That's
so
correct.
Under his logic, if you could do it under D, and this would be intrinsic fraud anyway, not extrinsic fraud, so you couldn't. But if you could do it under D, you could do it under A when you're filing a motion in the court that issues the order you're attacking. So it's a circular argument to begin with.
That's correct. And the department filed their motion under, I guess, the most analogous would be subsection A. And it is a circular argument. You have to, I guess, wait for somebody.
I guess I don't understand what you mean. I don't know whose argument was circular, but mine is just somebody's got to bring it to the attention of the court. It's not circular, it's straight, it's direct. Somebody's got to bring it to the attention of the court for the court to
And to answer
the justice's question, I would say I don't think it's necessary for someone to bring it to the court because the court may consider it sua sponte.
I agree with that.
So to the extent somebody needs to bring it, it can be brought, I think, at any time the parties are aware that the SCOP is in non-compliance, the person who has received the appointment is in non-compliance with the statute.
So your argument is that Rule 1:1 is not a final order, that this order was not a final order that expired after 21 days, and something other than a pleading in the initial case where the petition was filed needed to be done?
I don't believe that's correct. I don't believe that, and I think the circuit court had it correct in saying the initial appointment was a final order. And because it's something that could have been appealed by the applicant if his application was denied. What the focus is on is the March 24th order, does the court have subject matter jurisdiction to enter that revoking?
Well, is their argument subject matter jurisdiction, or is their argument active jurisdiction, that whole argument that we always have about what jurisdiction means? But I note sometimes subject matter is used and sometimes just jurisdiction is used. But I think my question is more fundamental. If we all agree that the initial appointing order was a final order, 21 days expired, how does this matter, as a practical matter, come before the court again if you cannot just file a pleading in a matter that has already become final and Rule 1:1 is run?
Just to rephrase your question.
Sure.
Because the order was final, the July order was final, as a practical matter, how does the court receive this information to make its determination to revoke?
Now, how does a pleading... What is the proper way to get the information before the court? Can you file a pleading in the matter that is now final and Rule 1:1 it's now final, or do you file an independent action under 8.01428?
I believe the correct matter would be to file it on the initial petition with the closed final order, so that the make it easier on the court to identify what orders we're talking about, to avoid having any type of fees assessed if it's, you know, non-Commonwealth entity
and
bringing.
And under what
these
authority does one do that?
And quite frankly, the statute doesn't provide any explicit authority, but I believe it's the inherent ability of the court to decide to revoke these appointments or not to revoke them.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Suppose a circuit judge enters a final injunction order in a contract dispute case, and the final injunction order orders one of the contracting parties to specifically perform a contract subject to certain conditions subsequent in the injunction order. Final order, it can be appealed, not a problem, right? And later, 3 months later, it turns out that the conditions subsequent to the entry of the specific performance injunction order are not being met. Would the court have the authority to say, well, I'm going to enforce my order, the conditions subsequent have not been met, and I'm not revoking or vacating my earlier injunction, I'm enforcing it, actually, because the condition subsequent has not been met. Isn't that analogous to what's happening here?
And I believe that's directly analogous. That's exactly what's happened, is the court is looking at the petition the way it was appointed, the way the application was processed and the appointment was granted, and continuing to have compliance with that appointment, and revisiting that appointment to determine compliance. So it's exactly the situation you described, the circuit court granting a final injunction and then having the jurisdiction to make sure that injunction is continuing.
Because let me ask you a question that's more back on this case. I'm looking at page 7 of the record, which talks about in paragraph number 2, it says, upon termination of the appointee's employment with the petitioner, as of the date of the termination, he'll be terminated without any further action of the court. And this order should be of no further force and effect. How can you have that if Rule 1:1 controls the order? It's sort of the same situation Justice Kelsey just gave you.
And maybe that's what takes this order out of Rule 1:1. And that was something that we discussed in the trial court was initially was whether or not this particular order was subject to Rule 1:1. And perhaps that provision does give the court jurisdiction, a continuous jurisdiction over this order, which would relieve it from the 21-day rule under 1:1.
But, the way we say this is really important. In the injunction scenario, and in the scenario that Justice Millett and I are talking about with this order, it's not that the original appointment order is being vacated. It's being enforced. So it's not that 1:1 is inapplicable because the judge 30 days later wants to rethink the whole thing from scratch.
Correct. And that was what we fleshed out, prior to this March order, was figuring out what jurisdiction the trial court has. And the trial court, in its March order, this reflects the ruling that you kind of announced, is that this July order is a final order. Rule 1:1 does apply in terms of the finality of it, in terms of its appeal. But the court does retain jurisdiction to ensure compliance with the appointee as it relates to both the order and the provisions contained in the ESCOP statute, which is 19.213-13.
So the court later found there was noncompliance with the statute, which was a condition subsequent to the order, and the appointment, not the order, was revoked.
That's correct.
And that's the point. Because I think both Justice Millett and Justice Kelsey raised an excellent point. The question is whether or not the court's supervision of its appointment is ongoing or not. Because there are plenty of cases we have where you enter a final judgment, but the court still has control over the matter before it.
That's correct.
And you didn't point anything to us until just now. Justice Millett pointed something out that would infer that.
Well, I'm very grateful he did.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Were you aware of Senate Bill 1195?
I was, Your Honor.
You're just going to hold it in your back pocket? Don't you think we'd be interested to know that?
Well, Your Honor, I know the General Assembly does work in strange ways, and I realize the bill's going to conference, which I think Your Honor's faith in the General Assembly of getting a bill out of conference is a little greater than mine. So I wasn't holding it in the back of my pocket. It's just, if it was something that passed the General Assembly, obviously I'd bring it to the court's attention. But I think at this particular stage, it may be a little premature because in conference, quite frankly, the conferees get to decide what the bill is going to look like when it comes out.
The actual issues before the conference have to do with commas. They have nothing to do with the question that you presented to this court.
And I think if the bill may be changed in conference, I have no idea if it does or if it doesn't. But if the language gets stripped out and we're kind of left with what we have, or if no bill comes out of conference, the statute's going to remain the same.
So you think that as the lawyer for the department, that you had no responsibility to let us know that this, within the next week or so, might be signed into law?
I have the responsibility to inform the court if it is going to become law or if it is going to be advanced. At this particular stage, I don't know if...
You see, you're actually depriving him of an argument. His argument would be, well, they didn't have to put this in here, so it must have been otherwise before.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a fair way to deal with opposing counsel?
I don't know if it's a necessarily fair or unfair way, Your Honor. And to my argument would be, it's probably a statement of declaratory existing law.
Well, wouldn't you want to tell us that so that we could make that decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, your time has expired. Rebuttal.
Just very quickly, with respect to this analogy to the court's continuing ability to enforce an injunction, we certainly concede that the court has such authority. And to the extent the order here requires continued compliance with the statute, there is then absolutely no information asserted, and no one has alleged that Mr. Levin did anything to violate the law or to violate the terms of the statute
after the order. He's not registered. He's presently not registered. His registration has been revoked. Am I right?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And by law, he cannot serve in this capacity without being registered to serve in this capacity.
Well, Your Honor, I don't, respectfully, we don't think the statute says that. The statute says that no one can be appointed without holding a valid registration, and he held a valid registration at the time he was appointed.
Well, the letter that, and maybe you, this question should go to DCJS, but the letter that was sent to him says you are not currently eligible to work in the special conservator of the peace industry. And they don't cite any law for that. So I suppose you would say they don't have the authority to tell him that he can't work in that industry just because he doesn't have a registration card.
That's correct, Your Honor. We think they were acting ultra vires when they sent that letter. Now, Mr. Levin was advised by us that he should comply in the interest of an abundance of caution. But ultimately, having the appointment by the court is what gives him the ability to work, and the registration is what gives him the ability to get the appointment of the court. There's been absolutely nothing suggesting that he violated the statute after the order was entered.
Is that different than the license that he has to get from the clerk of court under the order from the court?
He's issued an identification card. I think it actually comes from the court. Court gives him a piece of paper, and he then takes that and gets a little laminated plastic card from DCJS.
So it's the same?
It's effectively, administratively the same.
Okay.
And with that, Your Honor, I don't have anything else.
All right, thank you. The court will be in recess.
All rise.